Any corrections or additions to the minutes? Without any, the minutes will stand approved as submitted. The next thing on our agenda, let me say this about the integrated management plan. Two members of the task force, first Mr. Conway and then Ms. Bowles, both inquired about the integrated management plan. On John's inquiry, I called the city about it and asked them to make a presentation about it. And you each have a handout about the integrated management plan. And the city people believe that we maybe need to read that a little bit before we talk about it. But I thought we might give them just a few minutes to bring us up to date on what it is and how it works and how it may have an impact on what we do. Does that work for everybody? Okay. Then let's proceed to the Mr. Thomas or Councilman Thomas's presentation with regard to streets.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks, everybody on the task force, for all your hard work and for giving me the opportunity to talk about how we pay for road infrastructure. And I've spent quite a bit of time in the time that I've been on the council studying how we pay for infrastructure. It is a very political issue. And I don't think there's anything wrong with political issues. That's what we're all here for. To me, politics is about finding the best community solution to all of our problems and taking best advantage of all of our community opportunities. So there are people with different opinions, and I think that the better data we have to understand how we're doing things now and how other communities do things, how we might do things differently, the better, and a good, open, transparent discussion is really important. So we're talking about paying for road infrastructure here. So I'm going to present some data, result of an analysis that I did actually more than a year and a half ago. And I studied a period of time, 10 consecutive fiscal years, fiscal year 05 through fiscal year 14. One of the questions that I asked is, how much did we spend on increasing road system capacity during that time? Does anybody want to take a guess on that? Over a 10-year period from 05 to 14, how much? Nobody's willing to? Well, according to the research that I did and the information that city staff provided, it was about $84.5 million. I got that information by asking for a list of all of the capital road projects in the Columbia that were actually completed as part of the Columbia budget from 04 to from 05 to 14, and then I asked staff to notate each one as to whether it was considered a capacity expansion, which would be a new road or a widening of an existing road, versus a repair or maintenance or upgrade project, which would be a resurfacing, entirely rebuilding the road if it didn't increase the capacity. So the critical thing was, did it increase the capacity or not? And this was the number for the projects that increased the capacity, according to city staff.
It was $84 million?
Yeah.
$84.5 million between 04 and when?
Between 05 and 14. It was a 10-year period. So an average of $8.5 million a year.
That was for all infrastructure?
No, that's just roads. That's just the road system. I do have data on some other infrastructure systems coming up. And then the second question, we do have a development charge for roads of 50 cents per square foot of finished space of new buildings. So a 2,000 square foot house generates $1,000 for that fund, and that is intended to help pay for new road infrastructure, which is the driver for needing to build. New development is the driver for needing to build new road infrastructure as we have a larger population, more residents and businesses, and more people on the roads. So I also asked, how much did we collect in those development charges over that same 10-year period? And the answer to that was $9.3 million. And I'm going to just pass around. I just have one copy of this that I went through and highlighted, but I have copies of the entire data, not highlighted, which I'll hand out later. But I'll just give you this. And this is the first sheet actually came from a document that Carol Schaefer sent around just yesterday showing the history of the development fee for arterial and collector roads. And then the other one, it goes back to a year and a half ago when John Glascock provided me the list of all those projects over that 10-year period, and he or his staff identified which ones were capacity increases versus maintenance and repairs. So that's the best data I have. That suggests that about 11% of the cost of expanding the road system over that period of time was covered by those development fees, with the other 89% coming from general taxes.
May I? When you say increased capacity...
These were road projects that added lanes or brand-new roads that didn't previously exist.
And... you take from that that those roads and those additional lanes were driven, the need for them was driven by growth.
Correct. That's what I take from that. Because the other projects that...
What about the situation of you might have roads serving areas that are currently insufficient for the load because of the population that exists at the start of your whatever period you're measuring?
Well, I mean, there are certainly different ways that these projects can be categorized. We did a total of... I'm not sure if I even have that number. I think this $84.5 million was... somewhere around half of all the projects.
Well, let me give you this example. If you were to ask Ray Beck, he would have told you that Garth needed to be widened 20 years ago. And yet it's not serving any new population. You see what I mean? I want to know how come you know that all of the $84 million was driven by growth as distinct from driven by a need to properly serve existing population?
Well, I think that is a reasonable comment. What you would be saying then is
it's that... It's a question. I don't know the answer.
Before the widening, the road had a low level of service for current populations, and that by widening it, you improved the level of service for current populations. And I think that is a reasonable comment. We need to find some way to figure out how much we're spending on infrastructure systems that's related to growth. And what I started out with there was saying new roads and roads that increase their capacity.
I agree with all that, and I agree we need to find a way. I'm just curious as to how you know how much of the $85 million was driven by new development as distinct from meeting current needs that were not properly met yet.
Better. Improving service for current needs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there is an element of that. If there was a certain road like Garth that was performing very badly, and the Garth expansion project, not that there was one, but
for the sake of argument, I picked one that was
improved, not happening. That level of service, then you could say that project was wrongly categorized. And we could go through and look at each of the highlighted projects there and look back and see if we have records on level of service prior to the new road being built. Well, obviously, if there was no road there, it wouldn't even have a level of service. But if it was a road widening, so I think it's a valid comment, and this is, you know, a first cut at trying to understand these data.
Fair enough.
Are we saying that the development fees that were collected were along all these $84.5 million worth of roads?
I don't know the answer to that, John. This is the amount of development fees that were collected. I don't know exactly how those particular dollars are allocated versus the transportation sales tax dollars or the capital improvement sales tax dollars that make up a lot of the other funding for the projects. So that's an internal money management question, which I can't answer. But I'm really just looking at the numbers. An 11% of the cost of widening and building new roads was covered by the development fees collected during that time.
Yep.
So I did do a similar analysis of four other infrastructure systems, sewer, stormwater, water, and electric. And these are the numbers over that same 10-year period that came out. At the top there is the road system, 9.3 in development fees, 84.5 million in total cost, 11% recovery. Sewer system, they're really connection fees. For parts of that time, we were collecting $400 for a typical home. It rose during that time to $800. The total collected was $6.5 million. But the total cost of expansion projects, and again, city staff created these allocations. We got the whole list of all of the sewer capital projects over that 10-year period, and they determined which ones were considered expansion of capacity of the system versus repairs and maintenance. And for example, there was an extremely expensive project, I think it was $60 or $70 million, at the sewer treatment plant during that time. That was categorized not as expansion because apparently it was upgrading the systems to comply with federal EPA regulations and not a capacity expansion. So I was very careful to as accurately as possible categorize all the projects either as upgrades, repairs and maintenance versus expansion, which in the sewer system, you know, I think maybe it's harder to make the case that you just made. Maybe it's not, that a sewer might have been performing badly and we needed to expand it in order to improve the level of service of that sewer, even without new development. So same thing for stormwater, drinking water, and electric supply. And of course, in the case of electric supply, there is no connection fee for new development receiving electric supply, even though incrementally, when you have, literally as we do now, 3,000 new Columbia residents every single year, we eventually have to do massive distribution and even transmission projects in order to serve our growing capacity. We clearly have high electric infrastructure expansion costs, but we don't charge any kind of connection fee, so 0% on electric. Those are the aggregates there for the entire five systems over the 10 years. About $26 million collected in development fees, $152 million total cost purely for expansion. And we can look at individual projects, and you know, I'm sure that not everything's been categorized correctly. And some of the projects staff said it was a bit of both, and we split those in some way to get the numbers. But it's coming out at about 17% there. So I went a little further to just kind of look at how the setting of these connection and development fees kind of plays out in the community, and I looked at other communities as well. These are just kind of a couple of definitions to frame the argument. You could take all of the costs of any public infrastructure utility system and divide it into two categories. And that's kind of what I've tried to do. There is a one-time capital construction cost to build the infrastructure, the road, the sewer pipe, plus the sewer treatment plant, the electric generating capacity and the transmission lines and the distribution lines, whatever that is. And that cost, the size of it, how, you know, you can build a sewer plant that can accommodate 100,000 residents or 200,000. And to some extent, some degree of accuracy, the cost of that is going to scale with the capacity you're building it for, the number of people in the community, whether it's a road system, a sewer system, an electric system, or whatever. And so to me, it seems that that cost is efficiently and fairly recovered with a one-time fee on new development. So if 100,000 people just kind of decided to set up a community and they need to build a sewer plant to deal with it, then they would all chip in a certain amount of money, whatever it costs, divided by 100,000, and build that sewer plant. And they have a sewer plant now that's scaled to the right capacity to serve 100,000 people. Now, if another 100,000 people want to move into the community, your sewer plant isn't going to work, so you have to double the size of that. And so that cost approximately, again, needs to be collected from somewhere. Logically, to me, it seems you would collect it from the second group, 100,000 people that are moving in, out of a kind of a fairness and equity argument. So we don't really do that. We fold most of the cost of expanding the sewer plant, expanding the road system, expanding the electric system, into the general rates and taxes that we charge our current users. So that can be viewed as a subsidy to new development, which makes new development cost less than it really should do in comparison with existing homes and businesses and buildings in the city. So that's the one cost, and we, like I say, we charge that cost to new development at about 20% according to those calculations, with the rest being folded into rates and taxes. The second cost is the ongoing operations, repairs, maintenance, service delivery costs. These are ongoing, and it seems reasonable to me that to argue that these are proportional, these costs are proportional to the amount of service that's delivered, the amount of sewage that's taken away, electricity that's supplied, driving that takes place on the roads, and the efficient and fair way to pay for that would be to fold that into a kind of an ongoing monthly utility bill, or in the case of transportation, a sales tax, something that is applied equally across the existing community to pay both for the quantity of service that you use and the repairs, maintenance, and upgrades necessary, separate from the cost of expanding the system for new users. And we do this. We do fold those costs into.
You believe that we tax in this area sufficient to meet demand of the various of the street utility, for instance?
So the street utility is funded from a lot of different sources, including some of our income taxes that go to Washington and come back to Jeff City and come here, as well as local capital improvement sales tax and transportation sales tax, and general sales tax money goes into transportation, repairs of roads, and so on. Do I think that it's adequate? I think it probably actually is adequate if we used it in a more efficient way. I think that, and this is sort of a separate question, but I think we could use all of our transportation tax dollars much more efficiently than we do by emphasizing public transportation, emphasizing walking and bicycling. We have done a great job with walking and bicycling over the last 10 or 15 years, and a lot more people are doing it now. That does relieve the burden on the roads. I think we can do the same thing with public transportation. We have to have a political will to do it. We have to have buy-in from stakeholders. But I actually think we collect enough money. We just need to allocate it right.
But generally, your thesis is, in terms of ongoing costs and expenses, we're pretty close to meeting our need.
Yeah.
Distinct from the cost of expansion.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I showed, we spend a lot of money on expanding our road system, particularly out at the edges, to serve new development, and yet we collect very little from the new development. What I'd probably like to see is kind of bringing those two things closer together, spending less on big road expansions, putting on more efficient, cost-efficient public services that provide mobility access for people, but collect more from the new development that is driving the need to expand the road system. Yeah, Greg.
Here's to roads. You know, you've got a lot more users, at least from my perspective, on the system that don't live in the community. You've got people outside the community. They're not getting development fees collected for a home or a residential property or commercial property outside of the city limits, yet they're using the roads.
Yeah.
So you need a mechanism for those users to contribute to the roads.
Yeah, and I guess they're coming
to a development fee
into Columbia and making purchases and paying sales taxes here. They're working. I mean, we are an employment center. A lot of that traffic is people coming in and working here, so they're contributing to our economic development through that way.
Utilities are very clear. I mean, because if you're using utilities, you're likely living in the community, some small exception, but driving is a little bit different.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, yeah. And that's one of the kind of unusual features of transportation versus something like water, electricity, and sewer. We essentially provide roads for free and then scramble to find a way to pay for them. We don't have a toll road system, and I'm not advocating for that either. But there is a cultural expectation of roads are available, they're like a public good, but we have to figure out how to pay for them. And I think what you say is quite an interesting idea. I'm not sure I can imagine finding a way to collect an extra public funding, you know, payment from people who are driving into Columbia.
That's my understanding. Your premise is that you think that the development fee is disproportionately low to the total collection, but based on the fact that we can't collect a connection fee or a fee from non-residents, we need some mechanism to fund their use of their roads.
Right, and of course a gas tax is probably the best way to do it, and there is discussion in Jefferson City right now about raising the gas tax, and even at the federal level, and several states have done it. So probably in the long run, if we could figure that out, we could even pass a local gas tax, but we have to get a two-thirds majority at the polls by statute, which I thought is really interesting. They really don't want to make that easy for a city to do. So just moving on, I did some research on a couple. Well, there's not much out there, I have to say, to estimate these actual costs. What I did in Columbia was do a historical perspective on a 10-year period and tried to allocate all of the expenditures between either expansion of capacity versus repairs and maintenance and upgrades. But I have kind of tried to research other communities. These are really about the two best studies, most convincing, you know, reliable-looking studies that I could find. And I'm going to just pass them around. I only have one copy each of these. I've tagged the where these numbers come from. And in Austin and Bloomington, a very intense analysis was done to determine what those cities believe they're spending per household to expand their infrastructure. And it's a bit shocking. People don't think that it's as much as that, but it really is somewhere between $15,000 and $40,000 per house. That's the impact that a new house has, a typical average-sized house, has on the infrastructure systems. And clearly there's a lot of range there between those two cities, either because their methodologies weren't exactly the same, or maybe they run their systems very differently. I'm fascinated by the fact that Austin reckoned it was 9,000 per house for drinking water and Bloomington only 1,000. You see the school system is a huge one there, and that's not really anything to do with us as the city of Columbia, but it's an enormous burden for Columbia Public Schools, and we see them going to the voters in April to ask for a very large increase in the property tax that everybody's going to pay, as well as more bonding authority, and a lot of that is due to the fact that they are adding thousands of kids to their school system every single year because of growth, and they have to scramble to build new schools. Now, paying teachers is one thing, but that is an ongoing cost. That can come out of our ongoing. That's going to be roughly proportional to the size of the community. But building a new school for $20, $30 million, they just got to find that money. And it's going to be never-ending having to keep going and asking for more expansion in the amount and the rate of property tax for the school system unless we try to get ahead of this and charge at least some of that cost to the new development that's driving it. $13,000 per home, they estimate, in Austin, and $6,000 per home in Bloomington to add one home, and the average number of children in that home that are going to need a desk and a classroom in the school system. It really adds up. And you could see the other ones there. Yeah, Cody, sorry.
How is that $13,000 to $6,000 attributed to the developer? Like just a one-time fee when they pull a permit, or is it?
I don't even know if anybody does it. These cities don't necessarily charge this. They've done an analysis in their cities. And I think school systems maybe very rarely have that capacity to charge development fees. I'm really just making a point that logically and equitably they really should, and it would actually create a more efficient marketplace where the drivers of change are the ones that are paying for it, because at the moment we're really out of sync where the driver comes from here, but the benefit is somewhere else, or the cost is somewhere else. But yeah, this is really just an analysis. I don't know. I mean, the school district wouldn't be allowed to levy a development fee. They would probably have to ask the city to do it, and we'd have to go to a vote of the people, and then we could collect that, I guess, or it could be a vote of the people that the city organizes, and the money goes straight to the school district for expansion costs. But just to kind of give you an idea, those are some of the ballparks. So I'm just going to take an average figure in the middle of that range, and like I say, there's not a lot of data, and call it $30,000 per home, and I'm going to estimate that there are typically 2.5 residents per home, a lot of single-person apartments in there, works out at $12,000 per new resident. So this is, I'm almost finished. So this is just a little illustration of a problem with something that a lot of people say when I make these points. They say, well, yes, I can see that the current people are kind of subsidizing the new people, but those new people are going to be part of the system in a bit, and then they'll be subsidizing the next group. So that's kind of often presented as a justification. But that doesn't really work from a logic point of view, and I'll show you why. Here we're going to have an imaginary town, kind of like I started with, where 10,000 residents arrive at the start and set up a community and build their infrastructure system. And we're saying it was $12,000 per resident, so 100,000 people at $12,000, $10,000 people at $12,000, that's a single infrastructure construction cost of $120 million. So there we go. Let's say they live there for 10 years, they pay off that bond, $120 million bond in 10 years, and they have their infrastructure system, they're keeping up with maintenance as they go. But then another 10,000 people move into town, and they suddenly have to pay for another infrastructure system to accommodate the extra 10,000. Another $120 million, if that is bonded and then folded into ongoing rates, that $120 million will be shared, because it's two groups of 10,000 people, equally between each group. So the first group, who's already paid $120,000, will pay another $60,000, and the new group will pay $60,000. 10 years later, with those bonds paid off, the next 10,000 move in, and we have to spend another $120 million for infrastructure, and we split that three ways now over that next 10-year period. So the first group has to pay another $40,000, and the second group pays $40,000, and the third group pays $40,000. And we continue like that, splitting it each time. The thing that is unfair is that the first group continues to make a contribution. It is a declining contribution, but we can see at the end of 70 years, the first group has paid $311 million, and it declines, and the most recent group has only paid $17 million. And then there's a slight modification to that we can do, because in reality, the 10,000 people don't all arrive at once. They actually, in a real city, they're gradually growing, 10,000 people over 10 years, 1,000 a year. So instead of that years 11 to 20 being split 60 million and 60 million, the second 10,000 are only going to pay half of that, because on average they're going to be arriving halfway through that 10-year period. So it's going to be split 90-30. And similarly, in each of the new decades, the final amount of investment in the new infrastructure system by the newest residents is only going to be half what I had. So it's going to further bias it to the earlier generations, and we get even more kind of out of balance total costs. And what seems to me as a more logical way to do it is to charge that one-time infrastructure capacity expansion cost to the groups that are coming in and requiring that projects, those projects to be done. And that's what that would look like. The $120 million for every 10 years' worth of infrastructure expansion would be charged to each cohort. So this is the...
Before anybody gets... I perceive you using these numbers only as hypothetical examples rather than as any kind of specifics.
I mean, the 120 is somewhere ballpark because if because I took that from the Austin and Bloomington studies, took an average of $12,000 per resident for building or expanding the infrastructure necessary for that one person.
But it is a hypothetical.
Oh, it's totally hypothetical. Okay. Yeah, it's a model. So what I've just handed around is the sort of 10-page report that I wrote in finalized in June of 2014. It covers that same time period that I discussed in this presentation earlier, 05 to 14. The original sources of the data and the city staff's categorization of the projects as either maintenance, repairs, upgrades versus capacity expansion are in there. The one thing that's different is at that time we didn't have the fiscal 14 development fee collection because fiscal 14 was actually still in progress, and that number changed. And actually from the report there, which I wrote in June of 14, I had something like $7.5 million for road fee collections, and in retrospect, it ended up being 9.3, which is what I had in the presentation. So a higher percentage than we were seeing then.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Which, what was the percentage for the streets with the 9.5 as opposed to the 7?
That was the one that came out to 11%, which I had up here with the pie chart. And in there, it was even smaller. It was like 9% based on the... And what I did, I took it from 04 to 13 because I didn't have 14. So it was a slightly different 10-year period. And obviously, 03, we collected quite a lot less than we did in 14. Yeah. Partly because... Well, it may have been because we were growing slower, but also because the fee was lower back in 03. It did increase from like 10 cents a square foot to 50 cents a square foot within around about 07 to 10.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to just wondering what these percentages would be if you rolled, if you looked at it as the whole thing as opposed to just the roads, which this 11% represents. Since I know the sewer is... I mean, for a portion of this was only $400, I think, and now it's at $1,600 a sewer tap, and it's scheduled to go up to $2,400. So that's
correct.
Like four or five times what it was for a portion of this. So I think that would skew the percentage a lot higher. Also, what were you using for the storm sewers?
It was the same methodology. We looked at all of the storm sewer projects over the 10-year period.
Yeah, what fee were you using? The development fee, is that because I think that was only allocated when you don't provide detention? Is that the fee you're using, not the utility rate?
Like the BMPs you're talking about. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. That number came from staff, how much we collected in stormwater impact fees. It's on, I think, that spreadsheet, very busy spreadsheet, and it may, so that may be
9 cents for single family, 16 cents for multifamily, and 19.5 cents,
which has also gone up just recently as well, and we're in the process of increasing that.
Well, but this is, it's a little weird thinking about this because right now there's, I feel like this development charge is only if you don't provide detention, which our ordinance now requires you to provide detention, so this shouldn't be getting charged for unless you're in a redevelopment exempt status. So really this might be actually going down from what we originally had.
And I think that having the stormwater management taken care of on site, as we do now.
Well, yeah, because correspondingly, we've also increased the stormwater rates a lot. That's hopefully helping contribute to some of these stormwater
Right, and those
things.
Rates, you know, I would see in a perfect world should be used to maintain the system, not to build more parts of it.
Yeah,
but
agree.
Of course, we're so far behind.
Usually,
we have to do
in development projects, capital improvement, stormwater projects are usually rolled up in the roads. I mean, so
true as well.
It's just
yeah.
a road thing. And then also you had, where was this? Well, yeah, the streets you had already mentioned, they had gone from 10 to 50 since. So I was just wondering, you know, if you just look in the last, you know, 14 and 15, I feel like that percentage would probably be a lot higher than 11% in actuality.
Yeah, and so I think we've moved in the right direction. We did take the road fee from 10 cents to 50 cents back in the late 2000s. We tried to take it to a dollar in November 2014. That was defeated. And the sewer fee has gone. It was, at the time I wrote this, it was $800 per home. We had a consultant's report, Burton and Associates, recommending that we take it up to $2,400 per home. I reckon that the $800 per home was covering about 25% of the expansion cost. So $2,400 per home would be covering about 75%. I'll be very satisfied. I don't necessarily think that the impact fees should pay 100%, but I certainly think they should pay more than 20%. And I think there needs to be a really open community conversation about what that percentage should be set at. And that was really why I wrote that and why I'm very grateful that you've given me the opportunity to make this presentation so that that conversation can be part of this task force.
And I like coming up with using or starting with this methodology for coming up with something like this for as far as a percentage that you could apply citywide with the development fee as opposed to, I know in the past there's been trip generation fees or negotiations with traffic studies, what they say you should pay for what infrastructure should be done. And then you get into, you know, the equity from this development and this development over here.
I completely agree with that.
So that way you could have a uniform thing, even though you're not looking at specific projects, you're getting
right.
as a whole.
And
so
it's a
I like the idea
rule.
Of increasing the development charge to bring that equity up. I don't know what it should be exactly, and I want to know what exactly it is now. I think it's higher than 11%.
It is, because it's now 50 cents, and that 11%, some of the time it was down as low as a dime. Yeah. So, yeah, it will be we could do a new analysis and count the number of square feet built over that 10-year period and multiply it by 50 cents instead of this differential number that varied over the time, and it would be higher than the 9 million that we actually collected. It might be twice as much, you know, 20 million, which would mean it's over 20% rather than 11% or something like that.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Is it fair to characterize your thesis as something like this? The new home necessarily causes a new burden on the infrastructure. Therefore, we have to choose with that new burden, paying for that new burden, whether the existing home, existing people, existing residents bears that burden, or to what extent the new home bears that burden. The burden's not borne by some middleman, the city of
There's
Columbia.
Nobody else.
Yeah, it's
just
borne by
groups.
Either or to some extent by both, and the point is where do you put the marker down?
I think that's a good characterization, Chris.
I think that part of the discussion has to be primarily I would focus this towards the utility systems, that each of the utility systems have an excess capacity. So then it would become a question, those new users come on, are they fairly paying for their consumption of the excess capacity?
Yeah, that's a practical consideration. And this is sort of supposed to be a theoretical analysis, but absolutely you have to build capacity ahead of time. You don't just add to the system as each new person wants it. So in practice, some of those bonds have been taken out even earlier in order to prepare for the new development coming in. But you can kind of average it over a long time span and say, you know, this is what it costs to expand the system for this many new residents over a time period, and come to some estimate of what it is per resident or per house.
How more complex, or does the analysis become more complex, trying to deal with the road system? System.
I think we raised that earlier because the utility system has a very easily collectible monthly fee, and we can cut off access to the utility system if people don't pay their fee. We have a kind of an established mechanism for collecting money. We have an established mechanism for collecting money from a new development as well by the building permit process, and we can withhold that until we receive what we say is the right amount. By the way, I wanted to just say, I don't think, you know, if development fees were to increase, and they are increasing on the sewer, I don't think we should have to collect that all at one go. And I've spoken to a number of developers who've said that they would be less opposed to higher development fees if those fees were staged over a time period that's maybe more consistent with them actually realizing their return on their investment in land and construction and labor and so on. So tax billing those fees, I think, would be a good methodology for collecting them that would be less burdensome on the developers, but also allow the city to really cover its costs a little better.
At the end of the day, it's the homeowner that's paying that bill. Whether
yes.
it be the development fee in return for buying that home and paying the sales tax for the road maintenance or development. So it's really the property owner, the user,
Although, not the
developers, the middleman.
And that's true. It will raise home prices, most likely. But I did analyze some studies that compared, like, counties within the same area where sometimes a development fee was increased to see what happened to both growth and the cost of homes and buildings. And while the cost of buildings did go up somewhat, the cost of land went down. So when a county implemented a higher impact fee, the land owners were only able to sell their land for less because they knew the developers had higher fees and they weren't going to raise the house prices. So the whole thing kind of found a new balance point, and the landowners lost some of the value of their land through that process.
Sales tax as well. So if you don't need as much sales tax collection to cover new growth, it should balance out as well. So it's still going to be the same amount of money needed in order to build the infrastructure. Just which pot of money is it coming from?
Right. The other thing from those studies was that there was absolutely no evidence that raising the fees dampened the desire to build in those communities. They did get more expensive, but they kept growing.
Isn't it fair to say that the need to improve the infrastructure causes the cost of the new home to go up 100% of the time? The only difference is whether the existing resident pays part of the cost of the new home rather than the new homeowner paying that cost.
Yeah, you can think of the infrastructure needed to serve a home as part of the home, which currently is only incorporated into the cost of the home to about 20% in Columbia, with the rest coming from the general pool of customers and users.
Brings us to another thing. Like, as a city, and maybe it's a philosophy issue, do we want to encourage growth as a city to bring in and grow. I mean, I think lower development fees, you know, in theory does, you know, maybe makes it more attractive for growth and bring in new residents inside the city limits, and which has its own benefits.
I think it's worthy of discussion, but like I said, and I can send you this study, the study that tried to determine that found no correlation between increasing development fees and reduced rate of growth, nor decreasing development fees and increased rate of growth. Neither of those things came out statistically as connected. So I don't think we should assume that raising development fees reduces the rate of growth or the desirability.
They're de minimis.
What's that?
They're de minimis.
Again?
They end up being such a small matter to the entire value that...
I think that's part of it, yeah. Yeah, and I think people develop in a community because it's a desirable community, and the detailed costs are subsidiary to that.
But we do have Boone County that, you know, I feel like their development fees are a lot lower than ours. I mean, just so you get the benefits of the city, but you're living in the county, we don't get all that. Like, kind of what you were talking
more
about.
More landlocked here in Columbia. There's a lot more development outside the city limits, and we wouldn't be collecting fees on those. So if you had Boone County low, city high, you're
right
now,
more
development in the
county,
and you're still not
less.
Collecting the money, so you're going to be short somehow and have to collect those. I mean, that's a challenge with the community like we're set up.
I'd want to do a lot more analysis of that because you get different services if you're in the county. You don't get city police and fire services. You do often have to build your own infrastructure. There are we had a presentation from Thad Yonke, and there are a number of other differences. So I don't think we should assume that if we were to raise our development fees and that it was going to increase the cost of homes, that there would be a rush to build just outside city limits without annexing.
Yeah, there's an absolute, I feel like there is a point, though, where, you know, try to figure out a solution outside the city.
This is a conversation for another day, but another question is, should the development fee structure reward building closer to the central city?
I like that. And in fact, because I was part of the committee that put together the ballot language for Proposition 2, and I heard what you said. I wished we had not done the trip generation component of that. It was confusing, and it allowed opponents of the whole idea of increasing the road fee to attack the ballot. There is a justification to that trip generation. There's no question that certain types of businesses do generate more traffic, but it's a nuanced argument, and originally Carl wanted to have a whole lot more categories, and the best I did was get it down to, in part of a team, to just two categories of non-residential along with the residential one, but I'd have preferred to just keep it to a simple increase. But the question we also discussed is what you just said, Chris, should we reduce development fees in the inner city? And I think there's a very good argument for that. And we discussed that, trying to define some, you know, I-70 stadium and Highway 63 or something as a lower tier level and higher tier further to incentivize more infill development, which does result in less length of infrastructure, at least.
A lot of European communities approach it that way.
Yeah.
They don't tax you anywhere near as much to build in the central city as they do in the outlying portions of the city because of the cost of sprawl.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Another thing that I'm interested in, and this wasn't really a conversation back in 2014, but I'd like you to think about this as well. It may be getting way outside your scope. But the idea of reducing or even waiving impact fees for affordable housing, for housing that markets within a specific price range that where we need a lot of housing and not many people are building it, to create that kind of an incentive for a social problem we want to address as a government.
Doesn't the infill argument and the affordable housing argument, though, those folks, though, still, if they're new to the community, are still going to school using, we're adding sewer connections, they're using the same roads we are, so you're talking about expansion and perhaps more repair.
Yeah, you know, this would be more of a, I mean, those infrastructure costs need to be paid somehow. I would see that, you know, incentive for affordable housing and incentive for infill being a separate layer with still increasing the overall amount, but maybe creating a break for developers that want to do the kind of development that as a community we want, if indeed we do want that. And I'm just sort of basing this on Columbia Imagined, which clearly called for more infill and more affordable housing as two of our needs.
But you're not saying that would be an answer to our infrastructure issues?
No.
Okay.
We need to find, I think we need to find a more equitable way to fund new infrastructure. And that means, in my frame of thinking, increasing impact fees. Now, we're already doing it with sewer, so I'm very happy with that. But the fact that we have no electric connection fee seems inequitable to me and driving the wrong kind of market behavior.
As interesting and enjoyable, and I love this discussion, as this is, we probably do have to move along.
All right. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity.
I got one.
Please.
One scenario here. I'm trying to think through. So here we are at the outer limits of the city, in the city limits, and the developer comes to the city and I'm going to develop this piece of property and have 20 lots. And so saying then the city comes in and builds the water distribution system?
That's a good point, John.
Are we saying that the city comes in and builds the sewer system for those, comes in and builds the electric system for those 20?
No, I think that the current paradigm of developers building the infrastructure on site should continue. That's the most logical. It makes sense. And I haven't mentioned that, but it is taken account of in this calculation. It's quite right, to my way of thinking, that the developer should build that on-site infrastructure and put that into the value, the cost of the homes. But that doesn't cover it, because that infrastructure on-site connects to the citywide infrastructure, which only has a certain amount of capacity. And in the analysis of the 10-year period, I asked city staff what were the capacity expansion projects in sewer, in electricity, and so on. So those were the off-site components. It is quite true that developers spend a large amount of money putting water pipes and sewer pipes and roads in their development, and that's appreciated and it's right, but it's not enough because it doesn't pay for the capacity expansion of the rest of the system, which now has more use than it had before.
I think if you don't say it that way, that people could.
Yeah, thank you for drawing that out. I do mention it in my report.
It's really that capacity, like you say.
It is.
The analogy is net metering.
Wow, that's an interesting curveball to throw in there. Net metering.
It's precisely the analogy that John makes, because the developer and ultimately the homeowner pay to bring, for instance, the sewage to the point where it joins the city system,
but
do not pay for their rational share of the already existing
infrastructure. But they do actually in the case of sewer, and it's going up to, we reckon, but
yeah.
Yes, that is the point.
Well, it gets a little bit muddled, because in water rates and electric rates, they pay for bond issues, and so the new users, they pay the connection fee, the developer puts all the distribution system in, and those 20 people are paying those rates.
Right.
And so
I don't think the analogy isn't exact. I made it was precise, but yeah. It's
so you magnify that 500 times here, and so question, did the city, the rates are calculated such that those 20 weren't included in the rate determination, but collecting revenue from them, and so that increases the revenue generation of the utility. And
doesn't mean it may not be as much, but it doesn't reduce it to zero.
No, it gets lost.
Yes. Thank you very much, Councilman.
Thanks. You.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the updated street infrastructure piece and see if anybody wants to make any further changes in that.
I guess I wanted to say something about it, but I don't know if I have a coherent all-in-one thought about it. But so this is going to be going to the city council to review, right?
Right, and as part of our overall.
Overall. And I just wanted to make sure we weren't getting lost in the weeds too much with these specifics. And this is, you know, it's getting to be, it's four pages now.
Yes, I agree with that.
And I feel like we need to make it more concise and hit some just major points and not go into so much detail, because I don't think they need to necessarily see all that. I think this is excellent information.
We don't need to tell them things they know at least as well as we do.
Yeah.
For example, what would you take out?
Well, that's where I kind of, my thought just, I hadn't gone through and, I mean, I thought about it and I went through here and I think we go into too much detail probably in the, I would be willing to go through here and do some edits and present.
Why don't you do that and I'll do it and we'll try to shorten it and then for the next time make shortening suggestions. Remembering that we have two audiences. One is the council, but two is the community at large. And yeah, they won't know everything that the council knows.
Yeah.
All right, and with the next meeting, both then you and I will both take a shot at that. All right, anybody else have any thoughts or guidance they want to give us on the infrastructure narrative?
We didn't mention our bridges or our signals.
Should we actually put in here, orange means speed up? No.
But anyway, I'm just letting you know there's other infrastructure components that does make it even more new.
Okay. And I think really once we start putting together some recommendations, trying to just base it what the facts are behind some of these recommendations, make sure they're included in the narrative, which we haven't came to any recommendations yet specifically, even though I've got a few rough ones, you know, that I will present. But I think this is definitely good information.
Maybe too much good information.
Yeah.
Okay, then. Here's a question that Ian's whole theory about development fees washes over into the whole infrastructure question, doesn't it? Should we set a time to talk about whether we want to make any recommendation to the council about whether the council should explore or take another exploration of the whole concept of development fees?
Hey, if you want to call it the trick of the matter, is how do you deal with excess capacity? What juncture do you build back excess capacity? And it's and as the excess capacity is consumed. Excess capacity is based upon the existing customers. Then as the new customers come on and consume this capacity, these people are paying for this capacity, and then this revenue that comes from these people flows.
These people being the new people.
The new people flow through the utility, and then how does that allow the utility to stay in balance? And it's just like the excess capacity. You know, you go down to the water treatment plant, it's 32 MGD. We're at 22 MGD, so we got 8 MGD. So
MGD being million gallons a day.
And so everybody in this room currently is paying for that 8 MGD. But as the years go by, we add 500 new water customers, and we keep assuming that excess capacity. But the excess capacity is based on the rate structures, based upon, not based upon the 500 new customers. And it's 500 customers the next year, and then the next
year.
No,
you lost me.
Okay, the rate structure, as it currently is, say, let's just take start the fiscal year, October 1, 2015.
Okay.
The rate structure's in place. And so, Chris, between October 1, 2015, all the way around to September 31, 2016, we had 500 customers.
Okay.
But the rate base, the rate structure is based upon October 1 of 2015, and so we get the benefit of adding 500 customers, whatever what their water bills or electric bills are, and that flows through the utility.
Let me make sure I understand. On October 1st, 2015, in theory, we begin that period billing all the current customers their proportionate share of the cost of the whole.
Right, and that year's budget is predicated on those
on the amount of revenue that we will get from the number of customers that exist at the point when you set the rate.
Right.
But during the rate period, you add Y new customers.
Right.
And Y new customers maybe, well, some will get added in February and some in April and blah blah blah.
Yep.
But they'll all put more money in.
Use up the excess capacity.
Doesn't that thinking imply that the city didn't forecast that they were going to have that growth and build that in to the rate base?
There could be.
Probably a question for the city. I know how we do it at the university when we build rate structure. We anticipate a capital part of our rate, so we know that you're going to build capacity and you're going to consume that capacity over time, and then you're going to have to make a rate adjustment. It is shared, but everyone shares from the central plant, whereas when you get into infrastructure, and I'm talking about distribution of that plant to the customer, that is not shared. That's because you're only building that line out to that customer because they need that line to connect, but they all share in some capacity in the plant. So, but I can see your point. Your older ratepayers have paid more in capital than the newer ratepayers.
Complicate things even further. Is a new customer, or is an existing customer considered a new customer if they disconnect their water and reconnect it? Would that customer be considered a new customer?
And that
paying,
too.
They're not paying anything while it's disconnected at the present time. We could charge an availability fee, and then the customer is disconnected could be considered an existing customer when reconnect.
Yes, I think it does complicate it more. But John, my question about John's, the scenario that John posits is that it's based on the thinking that we have 100 customers on October 1st. But we, by the end of the year, we have 107 customers. the revenue from the seven customers, the question is, did the city contemplate and build in the amount that they perceived the seven customers would pay during the course of the year? Isn't that really, mm-hmm. what's the answer to that question?
That is taken into account during the budget preparation. There is usually a growth factor in the revenues that's accounted for.
You say we're going to grow by so many, and they'll come in so many a month, and if they come in August, they'll only pay for 1 month, but if they come in November, they'll pay for 11 months.
Yes.
And they'll be...
Depending on how individually it's done in each utility.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
So the plant runs out of capacity. As soon as the plant runs out of capacity, you have to do the capital investment. So then, therefore...
Yes.
You have to do a rate adjustment, and everyone that's a ratepayer then pays that capital investment in that new plant, not the last 10% of people
who
that came
it.
In the last 10 years that really drove it to the point of exceeding the capacity of the plant.
And it
is a challenge.
It is. It gets back to
that's
the,
true with all utilities. And I think
it
roads,
is
roads,
very
are,
true.
Di- roads are different because I see roads as you got – there's no revenue stream other than taxes to pay for roads. Unless you have a toll road. A utility is a little different. You have a rate payer, and if you're not paying the rate, you get it discontinued. You don't get to use it.
Where do you put storm sewer on that continuum?
A lot like roads.
Yeah.
Although we do collect a fee, but it's more like roads than it is sanitary sewer, water, electric.
Well, I guess my question is, do we want to put a time in our agenda at some point in the future to talk about whether we want to make some recommendation on the subject of fees?
I think we do want to make a recommendation, or I think I want to make a recommendation. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think further discussion, yeah, I think we should
set aside some. Then let's...
It's after somebody has put forward a recommendation that we talk about it again.
Yeah, as a starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, having given Ian... Is it bad? Maybe we should give Elvin Sapp et al. An at bat. That is one of
the development community.
Yeah.
Somebody. Yeah.
You know,
I don't know if CMDC has a representative.
Somebody, but it
maybe.
Just seems to me that in fairness, you ought to give the people who would disagree with Ian on this an at bat.
And let's see, I do want to mention that that we're not void on the electric system connection fee process, that has gone through, and that is in the hands of the city attorney, that proposal to charge electric connection fee. And that I think it comes down to... it needs to be turned loose by the city attorney to have it legislated, but then I think the question becomes it can't be legislated until it receives voter approval, maybe in terms of the Hancock Amendment. But I just want to make the point that there has been a movement to remedy that, and that it's been underway, but it's gone to the city attorney.
Is the question before the attorney whether the council can oppose it directly or must only oppose it by vote of the people?
Correct. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the integrated management plan, and knowing that we're going to read it, but you might give us a little kind of introduction to this whole situation.
Promise you'll read it.
Yes. I mean, I can't speak for anybody else. I will read it.
Now, I think there may have been some confusion when this was presented to council at the meeting in January. What the integrated management plan would do and what you're doing as a task force are two different things. You're looking at our infrastructure and making recommendations on operation, maintenance, how we're going to fund it. The integrated management plan is more addressing the Clean Water Act regulatory requirements that we have to meet. There's not an option. We have to meet all of them. And it's kind of historically, and there's more detail in this information, all of these different requirements have been addressed individually, one-on-one. Example is, you've got a problem with wet weather overflows. We're going to give you an abatement order on consent. And you're going to spend X number of dollars in X number of years. And your community can afford it. And then 2-3 years later, they come back and they say, okay, now we've got a new ammonia criteria. You've got to upgrade your wastewater.
New
plant. Ammonia. I'm just making this up. Ammonia criteria. You're going to have to spend $20 million upgrading your wastewater plant. Your community can afford that. But they don't look at the previous one, regulatory requirement, combined with the new requirement to see if you can still afford it. And this plan would allow us to look at all the regulatory requirements that are coming at us, and there's a list of them in here. There's at least 10 that are probably going to happen in the near future. And then you can pick the one that's the most environmentally, you know, sensitive or that needs to be corrected the most, either public health or environmental, and you can fix it first. And you can spread out the timing of the compliance with the Clean Water Act such that you can maintain affordable rates. Brief summary.
When you say you can, it means the regulators will allow you to do that.
There's a lot more detail in here, and you need to read through it, but they allow you flexibility and to be able to maintain an affordable rate structure to meet all the requirements of the clean water regulations.
So you're saying if they say you have to do such and such with your stormwater, say, hold on, Jack, we're doing our ammonia. And they say, okay, finish your ammonia and then start in this other one?
In some form or fashion like okay. That, yes. Instead of just saying that every time a new regulation comes out, then you get a new compliance schedule and you just have cost added on the cost added on the cost, you can, with that plan, spread some of that out and make rates more affordable. And there's some things in here that if you read through it talks about you can address your most pressing issue first. Doesn't mean you can ignore any of them. It does not waive a single requirement of the Clean Water Act. It just allows you to do it in a more financially affordable way for the community.
It has to be way more financially affordable for $817,000. You can do a lot of work with that.
All right, I'll give you an example. We were approached in 2011 from DNR to possibly have an abatement order for wet weather overflows. Been talking with them since. When they first came out, the first draft of it, they had required a certain amount of work to be done. It actually spelled out what the work was to be, and it had an estimated cost of $57 million in 15 years. And that's the only cost that's included in it. But if you read through the thing, when you get to the end of it, there was another paragraph in there that said, at the end of that 15-year period, in the next 5 years, you have to do X. But it didn't have a cost associated with it, but it looked like it was going to be about $90 million. So if that was in place, we would be required to spend $147 million in 20 years.
This pushes it out. You still have to spend that $90 million.
Maybe, maybe not. If we can achieve compliance with the Clean Water Act as far as wet weather overflows go, and we've only spent $30 million, we're compliant. We don't necessarily have to spend the rest of it. If you do the abatement order, you still got to spend the money. But then if you were to go, there now is a new proposed ammonia criteria. So if you're signed that abatement order and you're locked into spending that $147 million and they adopt the new ammonia criteria and then they decide in our next permit cycle, you've got to meet this new criteria. We're talking about another $50 million plant expansion to meet it. Now you got to come up with another $50 million in that same time frame. And if you come up with another TMDL on Grindstone Creek for bacteria, now you've got to meet that in that same time frame. Whereas the hope with this plan is that it would allow for shifting of the priorities. Which one of these problems is the most important? Which one do we need to focus on first?
You only can shift those priorities with
and you
plan.
Shift them back and forth. Now, it doesn't mean the rates won't go up, because you will have to spend more money to meet these requirements, but you don't have to do it with just one order after another or compliance schedules. So it's costly.
Expensive mechanism for the.
It's an expensive
EPA.
Mechanism, and it's voluntary. But I think overall it would be more advantageous for us as a community because it does allow community input. As a matter of fact, it requires community input.
I saw there's a lot of that.
And otherwise, it's, you know, here's the new regulation. You got to meet it, and you got 5 years. I don't know if that's helpful at all. I mean, I hope if you can read this, then you
it is. It's very
then
helpful.
You get a better understanding. I think Springfield has gone down this path to some extent. Other than that, I don't know of any community in the state that's attempted it.
Let us.
And I'm not aware of more than just a handful of municipalities or utilities across the nation that's even started it yet.
Well, I hope it does give us some goodwill with EPA then.
Let us read it, and we know where to find you. You're not hard to find.
I do have a question on it. Is this a lump sum with HDR or for a single project, or is it ongoing, reoccurring for a term that they'll be working on this plan with you?
It's an hourly rate, not to exceed amount of that $817,000 to prepare a plan that meets the scope that's in here.
Right, and it could take multiple years to achieve that.
Well,
originally we were attempting to do, we had high hopes of doing it real quick. Right now, I think we've got about a year's time frame allotted. It'd probably take longer.
And the challenge is it's a process, so it's not like you've got a real defined scope that you can get a lump sum price from the engineer. It would change, so it's real hard to define. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the contract runs for 730 days. Okay, it's a little bit confusing. So what I see over here are all these capital improvement projects that will come out of the IMP as a result of regulatory matters. And then is the mayor's task force over here gauging all the other capital improvement projects that are non-regulatory? And then if that is true, then how do we blend the two to make a recommendation? Or is it two independent recommendations?
I mean, the recommendations of this task force as it relates to stormwater and sanitary sewer will be taken into account as cost in this integrated management plan.
I think the plan is just a plan. It's still the CIP is where the CIP's, budget is what actually authorizes the projects, and they're on the CIP.
The CIP, as it's developed, as it exists, will be taken into account as part of our overall cost, as well as our operating costs at the plant, operating costs, collection systems, maintenance costs for all.
The IMP is just, I mean, that might and present additional projects to be put on the CIP list.
Yes, if, for instance,
it's not going to have its own separate list of projects in this list.
No, it would be more of if this regulation comes into play, this would be what we'd anticipate would have to be done and the cost associated with it. It's the way I would envision it at this time. We haven't even had a kickoff meeting or anything.
Yeah.
And if you recall, we recommended that the city, at least on stormwater, which I assume would be similar to the sanitary, that they come up with a hierarchy for ranking those regulatory requirements is one of the higher requirements. And you have to do those. You can't.
Yeah.
Down the road.
And hierarchy, and then you also have got timelines that are proposed by EPA at this point as to when different regulations will come into play. And I don't know if I made it clear, but this plan does include both the sanitary sewer system and the stormwater system, both together.
You said HDR did this for another Missouri community?
HDR has been involved with Springfield's.
Springfield.
But that's the only other community in the state that I'm aware of that's even really investigated it. As far as following the EPA's framework, there's may have been some sort of hybrid.
How would increasing downtown sewer capacity fit into the integrated management plan?
You had a CIP project for anything, downtown sewer capacity, extension out to Midway, up Henderson Branch, any of those would just be included as a cost. Our capital improvement projects list, And you just have to prioritize things as part of the integrated management plan as to when it would be done, or if something else was more pressing, it may not be done.
Let's see, David. So
the plan's not going to determine whether or not you need to provide increased capacity downtown, or whether or not you need to provide an extension to serve areas that aren't currently served. That would be prioritized based on city policies and the capital and CIP that's currently in place and the master planning report that we already have.
But maybe Bill's saying, well, if you got this big need for increased capacity downtown and you have this integrated management plan requirement from EPA saying you have to...
That's what the plan will do, figure out which one do you do first. Your most pressing need would be able to be addressed first.
But that was on the regulatory side, not on the capacity side, right?
But you're going to have to...
The CIP, that's where you...
You're going to have to balance the funding, and that's what the plan would allow you to do to help maintain more stable, affordable rates. If that makes sense, I mean, you got fixed costs. You got to operate the plant. That cost has to happen every year. That's not a optional cost, and so that would be in there as pretty. I mean, if you read through here, you'll a lot more of that will probably make more sense after reading it. As opposed to just trying to explain it in 10 minutes.
Put it on the agenda again, and we will rope David back here.
Okay.
That looks like we reached the end of the agenda. Does anyone else have any matters or comments?
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Let's see. With the advent of the council's putting on hold the electrical transmission line project, and it's unknown as to when, what that would ever happen. It would seem that we would be hamstrung in our ability to move forward with the electrical downtown without knowing the outcome of that issue.
You know, I thought about that, and I'm wondering why that is. Because what we're trying to tell them, and what they want us to tell them, I believe, is what do we need to do? And then it's up to them when they do it and how they solve their political hassles with the neighbors in that area. But I think the fact that they want to delay that has nothing to do with whether we recommend that you need to do X or Y going into the future, does it? I mean,
we have to determine what the capacity is for the downtown.
Oh, you mean if they don't do it, then there's no capacity?
Yeah.
Well, again,
do we even go? I mean, this is pretty far out, but do we? Weigh in on that issue.
I don't want to get into weighing in on which route.
Yeah, that, I mean,
if that's what you were getting at.
Pardon.
I feel like that'd probably be out of our scope getting into the actual extension project, transmission project itself.
And I got nothing to say about that that doesn't end up on the front page of the paper.
I see it different because the city has to do an evaluation on how much capacity to have to serve. That rolls back into that other transmission project, but that cascades down. We need to define how the downtown area needs to be served, the capacity that's needed, how to charge for that, whether development fee is charged, a connection fee, or some other mechanism in order to bring the revenue. As long as we're not capturing the entire distribution transmission system, we're just looking at the downtown area, I don't see a reason why we couldn't pursue.
Okay, anything else?
Chris, I requested the ordinance on snow removal from sidewalks.
You did.
Which staff provided.
They did provide it.
Yes.
Cool. Thank you.
I'd like to challenge the task force to come up with a better ordinance.
On snow removal.
From sidewalks. In my opinion, that ordinance is not working very well.
I wonder if it's, isn't snow removal more in the, I mean, I'm not sure you're wrong, but it just, the, my immediate thought is that snow removal doesn't go to the question of the infrastructure itself. It goes to how we maintain. I mean, who does what? Who drives the truck where, and those kinds of things. And that seems to be much more day-to-day management, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, I'm not sure you're, I'm right, and you're wrong.
City didn't remove snow from sidewalks. The property owner removes snow from sidewalks. There's an ordinance that says that they shall do it, but it's not being enforced, I don't believe. This is very
How
big.
Old do you have to be? I want these guys to come out and shovel my driveway.
Yeah, will they do your driveway too?
This is a very big issue in the disabled community. This is a big issue in the disabled community.
Yeah?
According to a lot of people, how they get around.
Okay.
I think if the task force could cook up with a better ordinance, a recommendation for a better ordinance, it would be worthwhile.
You want to submit us something, to, and then we'll take a few minutes at some point and talk about it?
Sure.
All right. Let's do that.
Next meeting is?
The next meeting is when?
March 2nd.
March 2nd. Here being City Hall. At night, at 7, right? Okay.
7:30.
That's right. Worry about the damn children. With no further business, we'll be adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.